Good morning. This is the Peace and Justice program. That was Sweet Honey and the Rock and More Than a Paycheck, which is a song I usually play around tax time for those of us in this country. And today I play it for a different reason. You're listening to the Peace and Justice program. We're here with you every Friday from 11:30 to 1. And I have on the line with me Natasha Iskander. She is the author of Does Skill Make Us Human? Migrant Workers in 21st Century Qatar and Beyond. Natasha Iskander is Associate Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy at New York's University Wagner School of Public Service. Dr. Iskander received her PhD in Management at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She holds a Master's in City Planning from MIT and a BA in Cultural Studies from Stanford University. In addition to her research, she engages in development work with partners ranging from the World Bank to small NGOs internationally and in the United States on issues of urban development, migration and development policy, and migrant worker rights. She conducts research on the relationship between migration and economic development. She has published widely, looking specifically at immigration, skill, economic development, and workers' rights. Today, we're going to be talking about her book, Does Skill Make Us Human? And just so you will know, she is the only researcher in the world who has managed sustained and proximate access to Qatar's construction sites and construction workers. She spent a year on Qatar's construction sites in its design firms and government offices, in its labor camps and training centers, conducting interviews in 8 languages and shadowing workers for hundreds of hours as they worked. She also traveled to the places that workers were from, Nepal, Philippines, India, to examine how people were recruited and migrated. Her book, Does Skill Make Us Human?, raises awareness of the crucial place of skill in efforts to overcome oppression and inequity. Welcome to the Peace and Justice program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Yeah, I think I told you I love this book, Does Skill Make Us Human? It was something so left field for me. I when I started it, I was like, and then I got into it. By the time I got to your postscript, I was like, oh my God. it's really, you really did an amazing, amazing feat, and I want to thank you for it. First, our listeners are going to need to know a little bit about Qatar, and I don't even think I say it right, about the construction boom that started in 2010 when they got the contract for the 2022 World Cup. So let's just start there. Thank you.
Sure. So Qatar is a small but very, very wealthy country appended to Saudi Arabia. It's right near Saudi Arabia. It's been in the news a fair amount because it's one of the world's largest producers of natural gas. And so with the war in Ukraine, as countries around the world look for other sources of natural gas to bypass Russia, Qatar has emerged as an important player. It has the highest per capita income in the world by a big, big margin. It's almost double the U.S. Per capita income. And in 2010, Qatar won the hosting rights for the World Cup for soccer, which will be held this year, this November, in Doha, the capital of Qatar. It was quite a surprise in some ways that Qatar won the hosting rights. In fact, the Washington Post reported that Bill Clinton, who was at the selection ceremony, was so upset that when he went back to his hotel, he smashed the mirror. Mm-hmm. But Qatar, immediately after it got awarded these World Cup hosting rights, started funneling hundreds of millions of dollars to reinvent itself as a global destination for sports and culture. It really used the World Cup as a juggernaut to transform itself. So it commissioned state-of-the-art stadia, which if you've seen the photos of them, they're really remarkable. Other tourist facilities, infrastructure for the games, artificial islands, luxury developments. And to do so, it recruited hundreds of thousands of men, mainly from South Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, to build these structures. The book is about their experience. The book is about what it was like to perform this enormous feat of rebuilding or building anew Qatar into something that was remarkably different in some ways from what Qatar was before 2010.
Yes, and I would urge our listeners to just Google the stadiums. If you don't do anything else today, go online and look at the architecture in Qatar, which I did at various times throughout your book to try to understand some of the scaffolding issues that you talk about in the book. But first of all, I'd like to understand why you decided to do your research there and your research design.
Sure. So let me tell you a little bit about what happened after Qatar was awarded the World Cup. Qatar, when it was awarded the World Cup, said this is a moment for the world to come to the Arab world, to really see the Arab world as it is, and not as some kind of fantastical, barbaric place, which is how it's often represented. You know, human rights organizations and labor groups did do that. And what they found were labor abuses, and they cataloged them. And the labor abuses they documented were devastating. The reports pointed to wage theft, often months-long, forced labor and forced overtime, recruitment under forms of debt bondage, where workers paid several thousands of dollars to secure a job in Qatar, passport confiscation, physical intimidation. They also documented the effect of the labor violations on workers' bodies. They featured graphic description of injuries at high rates and high rates of death. They reported on conditions outside the worksite, and they described how workers were confined to labor camps. And they showed photos of the conditions in those camps, which were often abysmal, crowded, with a dozen men stacked in bunks in each room, unsanitary, even some with raw sewage leaking in the courtyard. And those organizations compared, and the international press also, compared the conditions in Qatar to slavery. And, you know, you had all these press accounts talking about World Cup slaves. And these organizations and the international press pointed to the legal structure governing the employment in Qatar as the cause. This system was called the kafala system, and it legally bound workers, migrant workers, foreign workers, to their employer and made it illegal for workers to withhold labor for any reason. That means that they couldn't quit, they couldn't stop working, even in response to extreme abuse. And in 2010, when Qatar was awarded the World Cup, workers needed their employers' permission to leave the country. So you were really formally bonded. But one of the things that was really interesting to me is that, you know, Qatar is 95% migrant. Its labor force is 95% migrant. That means that everybody who works in Qatar, with the exception of a small sliver, is from somewhere else, is a migrant, and is regulated by the same legal system. There's essentially just one visa class. And the migrant workers in Qatar on the construction sites were certainly experiencing forms of exploitation, but other workers, professional workers, doctors, lawyers, teachers, even policemen, nurses, et cetera, were not experiencing these sorts of labor exploitations. I wanted to understand what actually was going on. Was there a more nuanced story to this? And, you know, the last thing I'll say is I really wanted to understand that because as an Arab-American scholar, I was really discomforted by some of the representations of Qatar as this kind of barbaric place outside the flow of history. You know, there was a lot of anti-Arab descriptions folded into some of the critiques of the exploitation. And I was really uncomfortable with that. I just thought that that was a misrepresentation of what was going on. Something was going on, but that certainly was a misrepresentation, and I wanted to understand better what happened. I didn't answer your question about research design, and I'm happy to do that, but I don't want to go on and on.
Well, you know, I appreciate that, because that's another nuance that I didn't pick up in the book, what you just said. That was, again, this is Chris. I'm speaking to the author of Does Skill Make Us Human? Migrant Workers in 21st Century Qatar and Beyond, Natasha Iskander. And Professor Iskander is Associate Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy at New York University's Wagner School of Public Service. And I would like to get now move into this the thesis of your of the book, which is based on skill and the language of power. This is something that I'd never considered before about how these recruited individuals were used and abused based on the definition of skill. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Sure. So you know, you said you looked at the photos of the stadia. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's looked at the photos can get a sense of how daring and ambitious the designs are.
Yeah.
But what is less visible, perhaps, is how difficult these stadia, but also the luxury development, the artificial islands, the museums, the cultural centers, etc., how difficult those structures are to build. They require highly sophisticated, highly advanced, really cutting-edge construction techniques. And I was just stunned. You know, I spent, as you mentioned, a year on construction sites in Qatar. This is the most advanced construction industry in the world. If you compare it to the U.S. construction industry, we are like a decade or two behind. The conundrum here was that the workers who built those structures arrived in Qatar with minimal construction experience, if any, certainly nothing comparable. So what that meant was for construction to happen in Qatar at this high level, construction sites had to act as vast training systems. All building practices, absolutely every single task, doubled as an on-the-job training process. And companies actually literally lived and died by how well they were able to train their workforce. They were highly deliberate about it. And they organized their every single process to promote learning, every single work task. But when I asked the employers, the managers about their workers, right? These managers who measured their worker skill several times a day and who needed them to have developed highly advanced skill to build these structures, when I asked them about their workers, they refer to them as unskilled, unproductive, and sometimes most dismissively as just bodies. And it became clear to me that they were speaking about something other than skill. They knew exactly how skilled their workers were. They knew how skilled their masters, scaffolders, their expert welders, and so on. They knew how skilled they were. They relied on that skill. So when they talked about them as unskilled, it had to mean something that had very little to do with actual ability or competence. And I came to understand the category of unskilled, which all construction workers were placed in, as a political category that subjugated people. And as I started to think about why, I started to look at learning. Because labeling someone as unskilled is essentially a denial of learning. And if you think about it, learning is fundamentally an act of freedom. I mean, you can compel someone to do something. You can force them to act in a certain way. But you can't force someone to learn. Anyone who's learned anything in their lives or who's tried to teach anything knows that learning is actually a deeply intimate process. It requires imagination, volition, desire, aspiration. And in the process of teaching and learning, you also need trust, social connection, and even empathy. So in denying learning, the employers, the managers, were denying that the unskilled as a political category had the capacity to access these registers of human experience, this agency. They were, in fact, denying their capacity for freedom. And so, you know, once you've denied that someone has the capacity for freedom, depriving them of freedom doesn't seem like a big deal. How can you deprive them of something that they don't have access to in the first place? So in this sense, the category of unskilled was not about skill. It was about political personhood. And it was about the use of that category to justify exploitation. And in my research, I found that it was this label and not the legal structure, not the kafala system, that produced the kinds of labor violations that were so carefully documented by human rights organizations and the international press.
Yeah. And, you know, what was especially striking to me, and I'm speaking to the author of Does Skill Make Us Human, Natasha Iskander, what I was most taken with was how you related the issues of injury to the home countries and to to climate change. And can you talk a little bit more about where these workers came from and who they were in terms of their roles? And, you know, you call them the newly poor. Can you relate this all to climate change?
Sure, yeah. So these workers come from all over the world. They come literally from all over the world. And, you know, the construction sites I was on were pretty big, like 8,000, 10,000 men on a construction site. And, you know, they were absolutely international cosmopolitan spaces. On one of the construction sites I went to, that one of the managers was counting languages, and he counted 22 languages on one construction site. So workers came from all over the world. But employers were in a bind because they had to recruit large numbers of workers really fast. So if you think about it, they get a contract to build a stadium, a museum, and there's no standing labor force, right? Like, there are no migrants in Qatar who don't have a job. There's no kind of labor market that you can just hire people from. So all of a sudden, they need 10,000 men. They need, you know, several hundred men every week added to the work site. So they have to find places where they can access large numbers of workers. But they're also, right, mindful of the fact that their construction systems are vast training systems. So they have to recruit workers who have the capacity to learn. They're also, the third piece here is, not only do they need a lot of workers who have the capacity to learn, but they also want to get them as cheaply as possible. So one of the things that I found really remarkable was that a lot of the employers were deliberately turning to climate-damaged places to recruit workers, places damaged by extreme weather, by climate change. They were seeking places, for example, wiped out by typhoons, or places that were suffering from drought, or places that where the fields had become saline because they were flooded by sea level rise and were no longer productive. Because in these sorts of places, climate change pressure made people who had once been relatively well off, it made them poor, newly poor, and made them available to migrate. So why was the fact that they were newly poor important? It was important because these recruits, these potential workers that employers recruited, had benefited in better days from long-term investments in education, nutrition, and health. But now they were willing to accept lower wages than they would have before because of the stress of climate change damage. And in particular, wages in cash were very valuable. So these migrants had the capacity to learn, to become highly skilled very quickly, but they could be classified pretty much permanently as unskilled and subject to the kinds of treatment that unskilled workers face. The other piece that you alluded to is the heat, and Qatar is very hot. It is one of the fastest warming places on the planet. Workers work in extreme temperatures, and they suffer high rates of injury and death as a result of the heat that they face. In fact, just yesterday, an organization called Fair Square published a report documenting that 10,000 workers over the last 10 years have died in the Persian Gulf because of heat pressures in part. And so workers were recruited from climate damaged places and asked to work in settings where the heat was damaging their bodies. And at the same time, because they were labeled as unskilled, they were subject to systems of control that didn't allow them not to work.
Yes, and, you know, we're going to run out of time, so I have to get to the last part of this conversation, which I think there's so much more to tell our listeners about, just in terms of how do they learn these skills, you know, just how amazing the detail you got into. And that's why I do recommend this book to not just people who are interested in the Middle East or anything other than humanity, because this is so important. The book is Does Skill Make Us Human? And Dr. Iskander, what I want to know is, what cautions can be gained from the political definition of personhood in this categorization of skilled or unskilled as we look at our own country and migrant labor here and labor in general?
That is a fantastic question, Chris. I mean, what I wanted to do with this book, because it surprised me, and I really found that it challenged my own assumptions, was to really look at skill not as a technical measure, right? We think of skill as a technical measure, and we think about, okay, well, some people's skill is not fully valued, you know, because of their gender identity or their racial category or their ethnicity. But that's a really great start, but it's not everything that skill does or the category of skilled and unskilled. Once you are slotted in the category of unskilled, whether or not you're skilled, you're subject to these forms of degradation. And you're subject to them in Qatar, but also in the U.S. And this is part, I think, of the kind of capitalist ideologies that govern our workforces, our societies, right? Where we devalue people, here in quotation marks, the system devalues people described as unskilled. And you see that in places that seem to have no relationship to work. So, for example, you see that in immigration policy really clearly, with a lot of flirtation with the idea that we should shift toward merit-based migration and just allow skilled workers in, again, in quotation marks, and then subjecting workers, migrants, who we define as unskilled, again, in quotation marks, to really horrendous forms of carceral detention, of police action, of family separation. All of those things somehow become more palatable politically because those migrants, those immigrants, those members of our communities are defined as unskilled and not as essential to our economic productivity. And all of that is not true. But that definition, that political representation, makes it more possible for these kinds of forms of subjugation to happen, these kinds of forms of oppression to happen, targeted at people described as unskilled.
Yes, and I want to thank you so much, Dr. Iskander, for this book, Does Skill Make Us Human? There's more conversations about international labor practices that I would like to ask you, but I have to let you go, and I so much appreciate your book. And again, this is the Princeton University Press, Does Skill Make Us Human? By Natasha Iskander. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for fantastic questions. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. Peace to you.
Peace.
All right, folks. This show will be archived, but I didn't start the play button until 15 minutes in, so I'm just like, I'm so sorry. You'll be able to get that full interview on Monday and half of it later today. So I'd like to thank all of you listeners. We're going to come up on another pledge drive here soon, so be saving up your pennies to help KZFR. But right now I'd like to thank our underwriters, which include Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with the Hightower Group, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with compassionate quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and is on Facebook. Again, Patrick Riley. Also want to thank Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. I'd also like to thank the Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit ParadiseGuilds.org. Also on Facebook and at 762-1490. I'd also like to thank the Bankruptcy Law Offices of Michael O. Hayes, a proud supporter of community radio. Michael O. Hayes offers complimentary consultations and payment plans for Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. For more information, visit chicobk.com or 530-892-8916. They changed their email. So this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on the program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers, just mine and my guests. And one quick announcement before we hit the top of the hour is that the police death by police of just Desmond Phillips took place 5 years ago on March 17th. There will be a rally in the plaza at 5 p.m. here in Chico Town, and then a march at 5:30. So that is a shout out to community who would like to change policing practices and get justice for Desmond and his family. Now it is almost right exactly noon, and I wish you well. You're here at KZFR Community Radio. I'm going to go ahead and put another song on, and then we'll get to our next guest. And here is Linda Allen singing the news.
We will stand like a mountain. We will stand like a mountain. We will stand like a mountain till our courage saves the world.
We will flow.
We will flow
like a river.
Like a river.
We will flow.
Like an eagle,
like an eagle,
we will soar,
we will soar,
like an eagle,
like an eagle,
till our beauty
saves the world. We will walk with our sisters. we will walk with our brothers. We will walk with each other till our loving saves the world.
All right. Doing our best here. Our loving changes the world. That's got to happen here, folks. I have on the line with me Juliet Beck. She is an amazing activist, a lifelong social and environmental justice advocate, mother, caregiver, and she has recently filed to become a candidate for District 2 County Supervisor in Yolo County. So, hi, Juliet.
Hi, thank you. Yes, it's official. I'm running for county supervisor in Yolo County.
You know, we could start right there because your whole platform, your whole life is built up to, you know, this campaign and expressing who and what you believe in must now be at the tip of your tongue. So go ahead and tell us about yourself and what you're doing there.
Yeah, well, I am, as you said, a lifelong environmental social justice advocate. I've been working for 30 years. You know, when you hear about system change, not climate change, that's my motto. That's my mantra. I've been working for system change for over 30 years, doggedly, because what we're witnessing now are these compounding crises, a cascade of crises that I call, you know, total system failure, you know, across the board. But what I'm excited about is the potential for us to be like Phoenix, the Phoenix rising from the ashes, that we can rebuild. These crises are human-caused, man-made. We, as humans, have unlimited ingenuity and creativity to rebuild our societies. And I believe that that is actually underway. I've been part of that here in Yolo County. It's an incredible bioregion, very, very prosperous, or supported, rich quality of life and an abundance of life and biodiversity for thousands of years. And it needs to be restored to that level of abundance. And so we are facing enormous, enormous challenges. But as a mother, you know, I can't just give up on humanity. I am here to protect with all my efforts, with all my energy, working side by side with my friends and members of the community from all walks of life to create livable, sustainable communities here in Yolo County to set an example for the world. Because this can be done here, it can be done everywhere.
Yes, and you have already led the attempt to get Davis Unified School District to meet 80% of its energy needs from renewables, helped Yolo County set a goal of carbon neutrality by 2030, and helped establish the Yolo Climate Action Commission. But your concerns are about the deep inequities that need to be addressed, about high temperatures, power shutoffs, water and food insecurity, impacts of wildfire on outdoor workers and children. Can you talk a little bit about moving from this broad goal of wanting to get the work done, about how one might start to address some of this?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. So we know that the climate is in transition. It's happening. Unfortunately, the effects are all around us of this rapid destruction of our climate. But we also now have the responsibility to make sure that as these changes are occurring, that everyone is protected and that the transition is just. So the framework that I like to work in is called a just transition, and it's going to help us create this blueprint for change, and it gives us a values filter, a framework for actually making decisions, so that every decision at every level can move us off fossil fuels, off of this type of inequitable economy, an unsustainable economy, towards investing in local community wealth building enterprises that can begin to stem the divide, the incredible structural divides that are inherent in the existing economy between gender, between races, between small business and large businesses. So with a just transition, we can start to think about investing in projects that build community wealth, like cooperative housing projects. A path towards equity is ownership, right? It involves ownership. So how can we have a stake in the ownership of land together, more cooperative forms of farming, but also things like looking at the finance system. We need our public banks. We need to be able to have access to capital that is non-extractive, right, that is just bleeding us dry through an enormous amount of debt, but actually access to banking and financing streams that are fair and reasonable to be able to reinvest in our community. So that's things like public banking. These could be game changers for a lot of our communities, and they're in the works. They're in the works. Another example that I love to think about is participatory budgeting. I mean, this is a all hands on deck time for people to be engaged in decision making. And one of the ways it's been activating a lot of community engagement is by carving out a section of the local budget and saying, okay, let's come together as a community, make sure those that have been historically marginalized, whose voices have not been engaged in decision-making, but that for whatever reason have not been able to have their voices and priorities and needs met, are here at the table, and with this percentage of the public budget, can actually think about what projects they need and develop those projects, and then the community comes and actually votes on which projects get to be funded at the local, you know, often neighborhood level. So this is just an example of how we can innovate and we can create new structures of governance that start to help support a just transition to an equitable and sustainable communities.
Yeah, and I'd like to refer our listeners here to cooldavis.org. I found so many things on there that really made me feel so much better about, you know, about what can happen, because it's happening in Davis. You all are really focused and actually doing the work that needs to be done, rather than up here in Butte County, we're just we seem like we're always fighting. we're just, all of our energy is going into the fight.
I want to say it's not easy.
Right,
we're up against big industries and developers who are not on board, and that's why I'm running for office. I realize at the end of the day, we need people who have this. Share these values and have this worldview to be at the table of decision making.
Yeah, and I was shocked that Davis or Yolo County anyway has not had a woman on their board of supervisors since 2006. So I think you do have some issues there. You know, a lot of what you do is informed by your work with your husband and the fact that you were able to go to the COP26 in November. I read an article that you wrote about how leadership must come from below. And let's talk about COP and what you learned from the people that you were in the streets with.
Yes, COP26 in Glasgow, the 26th meeting of the UN Convention on Climate Change, was really incredible. I was there with my husband, but with members of social movements from all over the world. And what I witnessed, what I like to describe as our collective survival mechanism kicking in. There were people from every continent that are actually putting their bodies on the line to do what's necessary to stop climate change, is to keep fossil fuels in the ground. The can has been continuously kicked down the road in terms of how we're going to address the climate crisis. There's been all kinds of, you know, cap and trade, all kinds of policy fixes, but really at this point, the only way that we're going to transition fast enough off fossil fuels is to keep existing fossil fuels in the ground. And that's what people are doing in all over the world. Like I said, from the Amazon. Hearing face-to-face directly with people who are defending the Amazon, the lungs and the heart of our planet, was just kind of, it blew my mind, right? It was just so, it was so moving. And I came back and thought, you know, what can I do? What's in my power to affect change? And that was what brought me back to my local community to organize, because I know that everything we do here locally, everything we do matters at this point. We're out of time.
Yeah.
When it comes to the climate crisis. So everything we do matters. So that's what the message that I took home, and it got me inspired to step up my game here.
Yeah. I'll remind our listeners that on January 22nd, the CO2 levels in the upper atmosphere were 417 parts per million, which are higher than it should be, you know, and extreme heat and drought are just on us. So these are wise words that we need to listen to. And right now, Juliet Beck, I really appreciate you and your husband, Nick Buxton, who I want to talk about in a minute. But I know that you must be as alarmed as I am about the situation in Ukraine. The congressman here wants to develop more oil and gas as a response to the situation. And you had some ideas about Ukraine and militarism, I think, that are important for our listeners, even though we don't have Congressman John Garamendi. You were talking about accountability.
Well, my first job out of college was working with then Ron Dellums, who was a leader in, he himself was a Marine and a leader in working to dismantle the Cold War infrastructure, to shift our priorities, our funding priorities, to health, education, and healthcare, so all the things that we need to have a healthy society. And we were dismantling the military bases and converting them to peaceful green economy use in Alameda County. And that lesson for me was that we are still at work to try to shift those priorities of where spending, government spending, our federal funding should go towards. And we saw during the pandemic, I just want to point this out, that we saw during the pandemic that when there was a common need for funding to deal with getting rid of the coronavirus and developing vaccines and developing this emergency health response, the money was there. The resources were there. And that showed us that we as a society can address our common problems, but not if we're beholden to the fossil fuel industry and the defense industry and these large industries that have way too much influence over congressional representatives in Congress and are impeding the real solutions. So I do think that as we build our movements, that the accountability to our congressional district representatives is incredibly important. And we were seeing this come to bear in Ukraine, where if we don't, Biden is making some good gestures at recognizing that we do have to get off Russian, stop our dependency on Russian oil. And that is just a huge announcement and game changer, recognizing that oil is being used as a weapon of war, right? Oil dependency and gas dependency is being used as a weapon of war. But the solution isn't just to crank up our own energy production. It's going to be to transition and invest in renewable energy, conservation and renewables.
Yes, and you have this every day in your home, I think, because your husband is active on issues of border politics, climate change, militarism, and economic justice. He was a co-editor of The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Seeking to Shape a Climate Change World. And his report, his most recent report, finds that the world's biggest emitters of greenhouse gases are spending on average 2.5 2.3 times as much on arming their borders as they are on climate finance. This figure is as high as 15 times as much for the worst offenders. This is called a global climate wall. It aims to seal off powerful countries from migrants rather than addressing the causes of displacement. And that is from the Transnational Institute that he helped found. When you two work together, it must be incredibly powerful. And I don't know exactly what your communications are with him if he is in Britain. Can you tell us a little bit about what he, as someone who is working on this from over there, what he's talking to you about right now is pretty much the same thoughts.
Yes. You know, Nick and I met in Bolivia. We both were drawn to the heart of South America, Bolivia, which is a fierce country that has been defending its sovereignty and has had a renaissance in native indigenous values into its all levels of their society. And one of the things that we learned there while we were living and getting to know each other and falling in love in Bolivia was this concept of chacha warmi. And it's an Andean indigenous concept, but it's the belief that your partnership, you know, as a couple is interchangeable. You're like a pareja. You're a partnership. And so Nick and I taken that into our marriage, and we do work very much in a complementary way. We see he's been able to focus through his work with Transnational Institute at the global level, but that really informs how I can prioritize at the local level. And so yeah, I feel like we're a powerful team, and I benefit from, you know, his policy analysis and what you're describing there, the work that he's been doing to just once again show how the U.S. and many of the European countries have misguidedly spent incredible resources in militarizing borders rather than investing in communities who are hard hit already by climate crisis, by drought and flooding and crop failure and heat waves. And all of these things that they're suffering, that instead of paying what was called for in Glasgow at the UN as loss and damage, you know, recognizing that there needs to be an investment in the countries that are suffering the most, that cause the least of the harm related to emissions of fossil fuels. Those folks, those communities, those countries all over the world deserve and need resources to rebuild their economies and take care of their people during when the hurricanes are hit. All of these crises are hitting hard now, fast. And instead of the U.S. and other countries investing in that, they're building walls to actually criminalize and victimize the people who might have to flee their homes. No one wants to leave their homeland. They're forced to. And so when they're left, and then instead of becoming, you know, refugees and being welcomed and helped and assisted to rebuild their lives, they're faced with you know, guns and surveillance and a militarized border machine that is increasingly, as we've seen during Trump, you know, locking up children, you know, in cages. Like, so this is just where we don't want to go as a human race. But it was what drew Nick into this, because he could see the future that fossil fuel companies were planning, that military companies were planning, and we are here to work with people from all over the world to say, no, that's not the course that we're going to go. It's history, and that people have a right to basic needs and support for their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, you really had me reflecting on my first guest, too, her work with international people who were, like, in conditions of servitude because of climate disasters in their homelands. Juliet Beck, it's a real pleasure to have you with us, and I don't know if you want to self-promote at all, but I do know that I wanted to get your inspirations in terms of International Women's Day. You wanted to talk about who inspired you, and I think part of understanding a great woman like yourself is to understand the great women that hold you up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wanted to say that I'm a product of California schools from, you know, first grade on through university. But I rarely ever had an opportunity to learn in my schools about structural racism, structural inequality, all the issues that we're dealing with today that were ingrained, unfortunately, in the social structures of our country. And so I chose to share about Anne Braden, who was a civil rights advocate. She was a white woman who bought a house, paid for the mortgage, and helped a black family build a house during the Jim Crow era to buy a house. And as a result, the house and she was targeted. The house was bombed. But she never gave up. And she's been an inspiration to me. I was fortunate to have trainings, and I go to the Catalyst training for understanding these structures of inequality, racism, how they're embedded, and how to dismantle them. And she's someone who has inspired me to be brave enough to take on these issues, because as white women, you know, we've had so many, there's ways that we need to stand up and are standing up to dismantle. We understand powers of oppression. We've been targeted by them and still don't have equality in our own society, but the discrepancy and the disparity across race is even more significant. So I think this is part of my calling, has been to learn about how to work, you know, as an ally in partnership with people from all walks of life. And then she's been an inspiration for that reason.
Yeah, that sounds important. And I know I've kept you away from your youth climate strike. We don't have that in Chico. What are you guys doing?
Yeah, well, it started in, 2019, and I think we're on our 127th week of being out at the corner of 5th and B at our Central Park in Davis, where we have the farmers market twice a week. And we're on the corner there with our signs, you know, signs like, the climate is changing, why aren't we? We're there always in solidarity with social movements and racial justice movements, like the Movement for Black Lives, that we're highlighting the need for climate action. That, as Greta Thunberg said, you know, no more blah, blah, blah. So the young people today, we've got a whole group of folks coming from the high school on their lunch hour to strike and to stand for a very bold, immediate climate action in our community.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with me on the Peace and Justice program today, and also good luck on your run for Yolo County Supervisor, and I hope that you set up a donation page soon so we can support
yes.
you.
Yes,
those actually, of us
yes.
who want.
So the website will be live soon. It's electbeck.org, so people can take a note of that.
Oh, I didn't hear you.
Electbeck.org.
Electbeck.org.
Yes.
Okay, got a ring to it. And so thank you. Peace to you. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. And I first met Juliet Beck when she was doing the Stop Clear Cutting California campaign with the Sierra Club. And she came up to Chico and spoke to us at the Butte County Library about clear cutting, which, of course, also has a profound effect on the climate and destroys the forest's ability to retain water, which is an important part of our water systems. Okay, we're going to go on to our third guest here a little bit early, But that gives us the chance to listen to this brand new song by Alice G. Michelli, and she's given me permission to play it for you, and she'll be my guest on the Pledge Drive program that I have in April. But her new CD is called Every Seed We Plant, and it's just such a wonderful song. So enjoy this if you would like to. I think you will. Here we go. Michelli for that wonderful song, and I also thank Pam Larry for her work in the community to actualize it for us. And Pam's on the line with me. She's been working on food sovereignty and security issues for 11 years, primarily addressing policy issues on the state and local level. After the campfire devastated our community, she decided to come back to Chico area and focus on creating a strong local food system via the Butte County Local Food Network. She invites all who care about healthy food to come join the network to create a strong local food system, one tasty bite at a time. She begs you to plant a food garden now. Hi, Pam.
Hi, how's it going, Chris?
It's good. I just am so excited about this Blitz, but I just wish I had gotten into it sooner, because I was preparing for the interview and I wasn't paying attention before that when I needed to be. So you snooze, you lose around here. But tell us about what you're doing. What is the Blitz?
Sure. So this is the third year we've been doing them. In 2020, so it'd be 2020, 2021, and 2022, so that makes us 3 years. We 2020, we had started off with intending to do 50 boxes in the spring and 50 boxes in the fall. And what it is that people either sign up to purchase a garden package, or we are able to often raise money to provide scholarship packages for the community, for those who can't really afford it because, you know, wood and soil is expensive and all that kind of good stuff. So, we get volunteers from the community, folks with open hearts and open hands and strong backs and trucks and all sorts of good stuff. And they gather the garden package, and then they go and they install them in people's backyards. So just like in the olden days of yore, when the community used to get together for a farmer and do a barn raising, I call this a garden raising. We did it twice in 2020, as we had intended to do one in the spring and one in the fall. But it's been an interesting adventure with these things. The first one in the spring, the second weekend was the weekend that we got locked down with COVID, so we had to find a way to get the ones that were the stragglers done over the course of 2020, and we did that individually, you know, with folks outside and all that good stuff. Then in 2021, we thought again that we would that it would be great to and then the fall of 2020, we were able to get a grant from North Valley Community, and we're able to provide gift boxes to everybody up on the ridge who signed up. We have 50 boxes. And then it was a regular old blitz in the spring of last year. And then in the fall, there was a fire, you know. And so we realized, oh, goodness, you know, fires are not that great. And there was a fire the year before, too, but we were able to pivot. But this fire had started, you know, last year was pretty horrid. I don't know if everybody remembers that time. I'm sure they do because nobody could breathe. We just decided at that point that we should just do them in the spring. Mm-hmm. So this year we're doing around 70 gardens, and we've got, you know, all sorts of fun folks lined up. Valley's Contractor Exchange has lined up schools. So down in Chico, the one that Achieve School is doing, Charter School is doing the Chico boxes. Ridgeway is doing them up on the ridge, and then Prospect School is doing them over in Oroville. So it's a wonderful partnership with Valley Contractors Exchange to teach young folks how to do construction, and the kids are loving it. I just posted a picture of Achieve today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the blitz.
Yeah, it is wonderful, and you even give them the plants and the expertise. You know, if you kill the plant, an expert comes out, helps you replant.
Well, you know, we started to offer that in 2020, but then COVID hit.
Yeah.
And so that wasn't as easy to do. So we are trying to get, you know, with our resources, anybody who wants to join us and help us actualize that, get more people mentoring other people. And so, you know, that again, one of our mottos is we're creating a community that grows food together. And that's one way. It's by people who know just a little bit more. It's not like you have to have taken a course, you know, or, haven't done it for 20 years. Even if you've done it for 3 or 4 years, we can always help newbies. There are some Facebook groups that help people address each other, and ask questions. So that's really helpful. It's just about us coming together and not waiting. You know what I mean? Like not waiting for the government, not waiting for anybody else to do it. But if you love gardening, then join us and, you know, help your fellow gardeners.
Yeah. And so the Blitz is sold out. There aren't any more boxes.
Correct.
But there is lots of volunteer opportunities. Can you tell us about that, Pam Larry?
Sure, sure. Well, we construct the boxes on Fridays, but we've got partnered then this really fun partnership with the schools. So this year we need help on Saturdays and Sundays. In Chico, it'll be the 26th and the 27th of March. So it's coming up pretty quick. So if you can join us, that'll be great. If you have a truck, even better. But if you don't have a truck, don't let that hinder you because we've got some trucks. And so we need extra crew folks to join in. It's a lot of fun. The different teams usually do two gardens. The staging site, Jessica McKenzie's letting us use her yard because she's got this great U driveway, and we used her last year for the Blitz. And you come and you have a good time, and you're happy, and the people that you get to see is happy. I mean, it's just everybody's got a big smile on their faces. And then in On the Ridge, we're doing it April 2nd and 3rd will be the installation days. And then in Oroville, it'll be the 9th and the 10th of April. So, over 3 weekends in 3 different communities. We've got people who have ordered also in Durham and in Gridley and maybe one in Live Oak. I can't remember. But, you know, we're starting to really branch out and, you know, to get these boxes all over the place.
And so for our listeners, they could go to BC Local, Butte County Local Food.org to learn more about this. Pam Larry, I wanted to get at the underpinnings of why this is so important to you. I know you can really speak about this, about food insecurity and about the fact that it's getting worse. And after all that really positive last 15 minutes, now let's hear about what we need to know.
Yes, we definitely need to know that this is, if you've never gardened before, this is the year to start. And if you have gardened before, this is the year to expand and also encourage your neighbors to grow. I am so encouraged by the fact that during World War One and Two, we were able to grow a lot of food. There was a government push to grow food. They called in World War One, they were called war gardens, and in World War Two, they were called victory gardens. We used to use that term, but we don't use it anymore because we found out that it's offensive to Asian folks because of the internment. So, and brings up sad memories of all the farmers that were interned. So we just call it the Garden Blitz now. But during that time, our community and backyard gardens grew 42% of all of our produce. So if you have an opportunity, grow it now. And also see if you can, if you're a meat eater, get chickens, you know, so that you have eggs, you know, or small animals. The reason I say all this is because the food system is imploding. It is collapsing. Our food system has been based on a global system that is incredibly fragile. And the fragility really started to show during COVID. I'm sure all of you have noticed food prices have gone up and they are only going to go up more. Because supply chain issues are amplifying and exacerbating and taking a long time to resolve on their own. And then now this war is really going to make it accelerate. We had issues with fertilizer, and while I was talking with somebody today, I don't really have a problem with fertilizer going away. It's too fast. When you're making, you know, global changes, they have to go slowly to integrate. This is going to cause a lot of mayhem all over the world because there's the fertilizer that was left. It was a problem last year, but Russia was still exporting it, and now that's cut off. Russia and Ukraine are one of the major breadbaskets of the world, and they grow and export 40% of the world's supply of grains. That's 27%-ish of the wheat, 17%-ish of the corn, and then there's barley and oats and millet and all that stuff. That's gone to us now, folks, this year. People who had ordered seeds can't get them because of all this stuff going on. We've got all sorts of shortages all over the planet. We are poised for major problems with our food system. So I'm really, I mean, I could go on and on and on, but I think I've given you the water in our country, you know, they're shutting off the water in the San Joaquin Valley. You know, I mean, all sorts of stuff is coming. So please, please grow your food. And I don't mean to frighten you, but I kind of mean to, like, inform you that it's time to open your eyes maybe a little bit. I mean, just go on the internet if you don't believe me and, you know, type in Russia wheat, you know, Russia, Ukraine wheat, you know, food supply chain disruptions. Packaging is a problem. Glass bottles are having issues. You know, producers are having problems with canning. You know, go into your grocery store, and a lot of times if you look really closely at the shelves, you'll notice that there isn't very deep, and, you know, there's a lot of the same thing. And that's because, you know, but they're in like 3 or 4 rows back instead of stocked, you know, different products stocked all the way back to the shelves. you know, our grocers are trying to like ease us into this or something, or just make it look abundant because people will buy more if it looks like there's more. I don't know. That's a weird psychological thing, but we notice it at our farmer's market mobile. You know, support your farmers so that they can expand. I mean, it's really time for us to come together, and I'm excited about the potential of that. So one of the projects that we've been doing is that we were able, through a very generous grant from Butte Strong Fund and North Valley Community Foundation, you know, bless those folks. They have been so amazing. You know, the Aaron Rodgers Fund and the Sierra Nevada Family Foundation have all come together to really support a lot of stuff in our community. We were able to write a local food assessment. We have the executive summary available. If you contact me via our Facebook page or via the website, I can send you the PDF to that. We just finished and just sent to the graphic designer who's, you know, Edible Chefs de Butte, Candace Byrne. I love our community. She volunteered to make it look pretty and more readable because, you know, when everything's so condensed, it's a little more difficult to read.
Yeah.
But we will have a 100-plus page document to share with the community, to be used for the community, to get outside funding and to understand what's going on in our community with, in terms of food, agriculture, and food security. We have appendices. One I worked on was the food disaster, because that's particularly one that's important to me. But so we have this. We're more than happy to come and present it to your organizations or your churches or your whatever, because we really want people to have an understanding of what's going on with our food supply. And then we are already starting the early stages of planning in a symposium in October so that we can come together maybe as a region, because it's not just Butte County. You know, plants and agriculture and bees don't see our county lines. But we'll probably expand it to the region and start having really important conversations about a vision for our food security and our food sovereignty. That's even more important to me. Our food sovereignty, our ability, we talk about this, you know, we can feed ourselves here. We are very lucky, and we have the capacity with very few resources compared to, you know, the amount of ag land we have. We could support ourselves with all the produce that we want, you know what I mean, here, and it wouldn't, you know, anyway, to go on and on about the exciting stuff about that. I mean, it's so hopeful that we're in where we are. And if we would come together with a vision and then start like a plan, you know, even if it's just the start of a 2-year plan, then it would be amazing for us. And so we'll be inviting the community to come and invest their time and energy and their help with helping us pay young folks to farm. Which brings me to another really exciting opportunity that we are working on diligently, but, you know, we're in the early stages. It's called the GROWN Project, Growing Resilient Optimism with Nature. And it's a project to engage young people to start growing more food, to become more food literate, to get out in gardens, to become leaders in their community, mentoring other people on how to grow food. We're working with the Butte County Office of Education. You know, we're talking with Chico State, we're talking with, you know, Butte College. You know, we just, it's a very exciting project and program. So, you know, it's scary, you know, to look at what's happening right now, but I just really want to encourage folks to, you know, count, you know, get your, you know, I have this saying, trust in God and tether your camel. You know, I guess it's an old Arabic thing, but, you know, get yourself ready. Okay, and join in and work with us and play with us and eat great food and like create this like food security thing. I mean, everybody in the world is talking about this now because of COVID and now because of the war. Everybody's working on decentralizing the food system, right? So, not everybody, but a lot of us are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the more of us there are, the more that it'll happen. Anyway, I could go on and on and on about that stuff, so I'll just wait for a new course if you want me to take it.
Well, I'm just so glad for you, because, you know, I know that this valley is a cornucopia for, I mean, you know, we can grow anything with our great soils here. A little worried about the water, but, you know, mm-hmm. we have a lot of opportunity here to be self-sustaining, and you're one of the people that is going to make it happen, so that, you know, if things do get really bad with, you know, being able to import food here, we can easily survive as long as we have storage systems with the food that we grow. So I really appreciate you, Pam Larry, every day. I wanted you to tell us maybe about the Vecinos special garden cleanup day that's coming up this weekend, because this is a chance for people to learn about, seed cleaning, sorting, starting, planting in the pollinator pathway, planting vegetable starts, and vegetable bed prep. So much that's needed for this time of year.
Yeah. Well, this is a project. One of our super volunteers, project director person at Vecino, Allie McMorrow, goes to Free Bird Yoga Studio. So it's an event in conjunction with them. And we're so excited about the partnership and really thankful to both Allie and Free Bird. And Allie's been working really hard of, you know, all that stuff, ordered the porta potty, was delivered today. You know, she's got all sorts of fun activities no matter what you want to do. Also wanted to point people to our neighborhood composting center there, which is run by another great young person, Amy Roseman. And you know Amy. And she is, we got a grant to as part of the community composting partnership across the state. So we are encouraging people to, if you don't have your own compost pile, that you can bring your compost there. And she'll be weighing it and tracking it and tracing it. And she will be there on Sunday, so you could talk to her about that, too.
That's great.
Yeah, it'll be 10 to 2. And Vecino is located at 1535 Laburnum Avenue, which that's 1535 Laburnum. We ask that you, you know, just like most of us in this world, if you can walk or bike, that would be great. And just be mindful of parking and, you know, and respectful of the community or, you know, the surrounding neighborhood. But we really would love, there'll be kids stuff going on there, you know, all ages. And it should be a really fun event.
Yeah. And this is the time of year when it isn't too hot, when one can get really excited about gardening. Mm-hmm. So we should really take advantage of learning during the times that before it gets discouraging, which it does later. Mm-hmm. So tell us some more about, like, Kentfield Gardens or some of the Master Gardeners and some of the other things that are happening.
Sure. So Kentfield Garden is run by From the Ground Up, Inc. They have been around for longer than us, that's for sure. Like, I don't know how many years, but they were doing a lot of installation of gardens in high-risk facilities to help folks there heal after drug abuse or getting out of jail or whatever, or, you know, mental illness. And they also developed this beautiful community garden off of First Avenue. It's on Kentfield. It's 1125. So if you're on the, you know, if you're on First Avenue, you turn down Kentfield. If you're coming from the freeway, it's a left. And then the garden is about halfway down the first block on the left. You can't miss it. They were able, they've got a beautiful outdoor kitchen there and a gazebo for any, you know, for use. It's a community space. There's also a free food giveaway box there, as there is at Vecino Victory, at Vecino Garden also. There's a free food stand there. So both, you know, we have some canned stuff at Vecino and box stuff. It's just become kind of like a repository for folks. But in the summer, it's full of, you know, a whole bunch of fresh veggies and stuff, both at Kentfield and Vecino. Kentfield has Wendy McCall is running. She's a wonderful teacher of, you know, she teaches kids, helps them get their, you know, hands in the soil. We've been in contact with her about the Grown Project. When we get that up and running, we'll probably incorporate her. She's got a baby and another kid, so she's a pretty busy gal right now, but she's a part of the vision and the dream. And she's giving kid workshops every Saturday there. You should go to the Kentfield Garden Facebook page to find out more about that. Also, our Master Gardeners, UC Extension Master Gardeners group is really, really active here does a lot of workshops. So if you go to their website, it would be UC Master Gardeners, I think of Butte County, and you'll find a list there. I don't have it in front of me, but I remember one of them had to do with bees. They also offer a a gardening journal. So one of them is about the journal and, you know, how to use it and getting started and all that kind of good stuff. And they just have a variety of different things that they offer. And I love our partnership with them. We've done a few things together and hope to expand that. So there's just so much going on. I just don't even know where to start, you know.
It is amazing. Yeah. When I looked at this list, I was like, oh my goodness. Pam Larry, I wanted to close with a woman that you admire for Women's History Month, a woman who helped create the woman that you are in this world. Can you tell us about somebody that you special to you?
Well, if you know, when you asked me that question, you know, in email, I was pondering about it. And, you know, in terms of the food system stuff, it would be Vandana Shiva. I have been blessed to be able to meet her. And she's just as much fun and just as fiery in person, you know, when she's on stage, and very loving and compassionate, and has dedicated her life to the planet and, in her case, to the seeds. She's a huge protector of our rights to sovereignty and has done amazing things fighting corporate takeover of the planet. So, yeah, it would be her.
Yeah. And so we still have 2 or 3 minutes. So
okay. In
terms of the planet, we talked about the food system and food insecurity is going to only get worse now. And it's the reason why all of us need to be heeding what you have been telling us about. And again, the website is bclocalfood.org. And you can learn about their mission and their objectives there, which I won't make you go into, but, one of the other issues in a nutshell about water and mulching and the use of water, can you give our listeners one little bit of tidbit about that for those of us who are old gardeners or new ones?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that I would ask is that people rip out their grass and plant food.
Mm.
Right away, you are reducing water consumption about 30%. The water goes to something that can feed you and your community, your neighborhood, you know, your neighbors, and it could create more community. Like a front yard garden opens up all sorts of conversations in the community like nothing else.
Wow.
Definitely not using anything that will poison the critters in the soil is really important. Probably don't need to say that whole lot about that in this with this audience, but again, you suggested mulch. Yes, lots of mulch. Watering wisely, growing plants but not overwatering them, and realizing that a little bit of stress is not bad for them. That makes their roots go deeper and uses less water. Composting is so important, which is why so many of us around this county, us and Soul Sanctuary, and then From the Ground up in Concow. Part of this composting thing, and then wood chips, you know, and other kinds of mulch on top of your stuff all save water. But the biggest thing is get rid of that grass, you know, just rip it out and you know, start a garden. And you know, contact me, because we've had a dream of having, it's called Eat Your Lawn, you know, to encourage people to, you know, to do that. It will be part of the Grown Project. You know, there's so many things that could happen. We just need a few more hands on board of folks. And I'm going to reach out to the boomers. You know, I'm a boomer.
Mm.
And folks, it's time to get busy. You know, we've got more resources and time. You know, I know a lot of us are struggling, but a lot of us have capacity to be out in our community more. And so I'm really urging all of us to, you know, step outside, get involved, whether it's with us or homeless issues or whatever kind of active work, not just protesting, but active work building our community for future generations.
Thank you, Pam Larry. Thank you very much for everything you're doing. You are much appreciated.
You betcha. It's fun.
All right. Peace to you. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Peace and Justice Program will be back with you next Friday at 11:30 with my co-host Robert Jones. Stay tuned now for Playing Dead and then Devastation Sounds to follow, so you can relax and unwind from this week that you have had. And I want to thank our underwriters as always. At this point, I'd like to thank the Chico News and Review, your local news, commentary, and entertainment source. The March issue hits the stand yesterday, the 10th, with the rebirth of the Environmental Coalition of Butte County, an interview with musician Melissa Etheridge, and more. The Chico News and Review is available at hundreds of locations throughout Butte County and online at chiconewsreview.com. That's what I'm going to do as soon as I get out of here. Go read the paper. And the Banana Grape Stomp, airing Saturdays at 10 p.m. at KIXE TV, Channel 9, featuring live music performances from Northern California. Bands include such favorites as ALO, Achilles Wheel, Tim Bloom, John Craigie, Mogo Green, and more. Hosted by Molly Knight, the Banana Grape Stomp, Saturdays, 10 p.m. on KIXE, Channel 9. And past episodes you can find on YouTube. So I'm going to give you the community calendar and find the host of Playing Dead, and then I'll be out of here to enjoy the spring with you. Peace, please. Remember, negotiate, negotiate, negotiate. Get those folks sitting down at a table somewhere so the loss of life and destruction of property can end, and people can, however it comes out, the Ukrainian people's will is strong and they will prevail. So don't worry too much about that. Just don't send in more weapons, more fighters, and no fly zone. Okay, that is the word of an old peace activist to you. Don't encourage I can't even say it. Don't make Putin a villain. He already is one. It's on him. Peace to you all. All right, here we go. Community calendar.
Hey, listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The Museum of Northern California Art is holding their third Friday's event for March, where everyone's a winner. Moncka is excited to share the details of their third Fridays at Moncka event. Join the fun with Everyone's a Winner, a night of games, puzzles, music by Lester Wong, and popcorn. There are snacks and a no-host bar. All ages are welcome. There is a $5 admission at the door, but free for members, and kids and students are always free. This takes place next Friday, March 18th, from 6 to 8 p.m., located at the Museum of Northern California Art, 900 Esplanade in Chico. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
All right, 1 o'clock here on KZFR, 1 o'clock Friday. Actually, it's a couple minutes to 1 o'clock. It's time for Playing Dead. This is Bill. I'm doing Playing Dead today, and I've got a really cool show to play for you by the Grateful Dead. They were recorded at the Field House at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, Iowa, on March 20th, 1971. So we're going to be getting to that in just a moment here. First, let you know that Playing Dead is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering organic and local produce, organic groceries, supplements, and more, as well as hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op accepts online orders for curbside pickup and is looking for co-op owners to serve on their board of directors. For details, visit Chico Natural Foods Co-op /BOD. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main. Also, Alternative Energy Systems, providing sustainable energy for life. Alternative Energy Systems offers solar, battery storage, and whole home generator solutions. More information is available at 345-6980, or you can visit savingenergyforlife.com. Well, hey, let's get right into the music here. Let's listen to the Grateful Dead, recorded at the Iowa Field House, the University of Iowa, March 20th, 1971. This is Plain Dead on KZFR.
Chips cash deal, keep trucking like the dude out there. Together, more or less in line, just keep trucking. Oh, 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 oh. Heralds of neon and flashing marquees out on Main Street. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's on the same street. Your typical city involved in a typical daydream. Hang it up and see what tomorrow brings. Dallas got a salt machine. Houston, too close to New Orleans. New York got the ways and means, but just won't let you be. Speak of true love. Most of the time they're sitting and crying at home.